Please be seated. This past week, I was in Virginia Hospital Center, not as a patient, but to visit a parishioner. After my visit, I made my way downstairs to the lobby, you know, where that circular desk is, you know. I needed to ask somebody, how do I get to my car? It's on G2 level, and I didn't know there was a G2 level, and I knew I wasn't going to be able to find my car. I had that kindly elderly man came up behind me, and so he decided he was going to direct me, and I think the collar was absent, although I did have a collar on. I think that may have been a tip-off. And he says, I tell you what, why don't you hop in and I'll take you to G2 level. Not a problem. I'm not a real humble person, but that's a little bit much for me, you know, pushing me around in a wheelchair, no less. Thanks anyway, but I can make it with my trusty cane. But he insisted. He says to me, this is what he said to me, God put me here to help people. A big declaration, you know. And I'm wondering, anybody looking at this? And he says, and today I'm here to help you. I figure, man, I can't argue with that. So, you know, I plumped myself down into his wheelchair and off we went. Along the way, I took a look at him, you know, I was watching him, and I noticed something. He has a sticker, you know, like the name tags. Only it wasn't a name tag, it was in plastic, but it was a color picture of Jesus and Mary. And I just couldn't help but myself. I just had to ask him, what's with the deal here with Mary and Jesus? Didn't miss a beat. The guy says, 27 years ago, I was walking down the street. It was rather late at night, one of the streets in D.C., and a young man came out of the darkness with a knife, and he cut me. And he made me turn around to see this. He actually came out from, he cut me from here to the bottom of my throat. He says, I knew I was going to die. He said, but I was determined I'm going to get in a last prayer for God before I go, before everything turns to black, you know. And he says, what I told him. He said, Lord, forgive me for my sins and forgive me for doubting you. How strange, I thought. He says, the next thing I remember, I'm lying in a bed in a hospital and I'm alive. All stitched up. He says, Jesus had given me a new life. And I'll say, and a new mission for my life. And this is a big part of it right here. I don't know, in the days that followed this past week, I was thinking about this old guy. And I shouldn't say old guy because he's probably as old as I am. But he's a delightful guy. And he taught me two lessons. One of which we already know, you know, but it was good for me to reinvest my thoughts about this, and that is that Jesus is always beside us throughout all of our lives. I've told people that in hospitals and all kinds of settings, you know, God's with you all the time. Never leaves your side. Our problem is we just ignore him sometimes. But there was a second lesson that kind of, well, it didn't knock my socks off, but it was something that surprised me. Simple, little message, but it unnerved me because I had never realized this. And that is that Jesus never waits for us to call on him before he appears. That happened that night in the middle of Jerusalem somewhere. They didn't know he was coming. They figured, you know, all they could think of was getting killed by the Jews. That's why the door's locked. These guys are hidden away, his disciples. And Jesus comes to them, as he does with us, unexpected and unbidden. He takes the initiative to save us. I find that not only gratifying, but amazing to think about, that Jesus comes to us, stoops to us, little ordinary us, to save us. Frankly, I tend to think that little lesson goes right to the heart of the story about Thomas. I don't know what the passage doesn't tell us, but, you know, we don't know why Thomas wasn't there that night with the rest of them, which I thought was kind of strange. I mean, if they're there hiding out of fear, what the heck is he doing walking around, you know? But he wasn't there. And Jesus appears to them alive. Now, during the week, they get a hold of him. You know, they see him, and they tell him this story that Jesus came to us. He just was there, alive in the flesh. Thomas wasn't so sure about this. My sense is that he probably thought, they saw a vision, you know, some mystic kind of apparition, maybe, but live, I don't think so. Kind of reminds me, it did remind me of that passage in Mark, and I know you all know this by heart, where this father begs Jesus to heal his epileptic son. You remember that, of course. Actually, I don't know where it was, but I think it's in verse 24. And Jesus tells the father, he says, all things can be done for the one who believes. And the man cries out. Always wanted to know where this thing came from. This line, I've heard preachers say it. I believe. Help my unbelief. Thomas's momentary experience of unbelief has now branded him forever as what we call doubting Thomas. Now, I wince, truly, at telling you this. But I'm here to tell you, if you don't know already, we are all doubters. We live in a society that fosters that sort of doubt, don't you think? Discourages us from trusting anyone. Letting anyone get too close to us, you know. Let alone share information with them. Yeah, I kind of tend to look at it like there's an ongoing war, you know, conflict between those of us who want to just get on with life, preserve our identity, make our purchases with a credit card, let it go at that. And then on the other side, there are people who are out for the scam, to invade us, to invade our privacy, even stripping us of our identity. My favorite, I don't know, I know you get these calls. You ever notice when they call? It's either around lunchtime, starting around 11:30 to maybe 2 o'clock, or at dinner time. Now, Carolyn and I have this thing where, are you going to get it or am I going to get it? Neither one of us wants to answer the phone during those hours, and we know why. And I'll tell you why, because my favorite caller is this guy who calls me from India. How do I know? This guy's called me every month for 2 years. Wants the same thing. He pulled this scam on my brother-in-law who bought into it. And I said, Frank, give me a break. What? I recognize his accent, so I would recognize him. And he calls me, and the first thing he says is, I'm a representative from Microsoft. Oh, by the way, that gets your attention. He says, and we have detected that there's a virus in your computer, and I'm calling to help you fix it, to correct it, so it doesn't further damage your computer. All you gotta do is just turn on your computer, Mr. Becker. It's you know, just turn it on. And that kind of spooked me right there. How would he know what's on my computer? He says, and then, oh, by the way, give me your credit card number, too, so, you know, the Visa number. It's only a small charge, $300 a month. Think you'll never have this problem again. True. My brother-in-law bit into this one. And Frank is a smart man, but he is one who is not a doubter. He accepts people as they are. God bless him. But it's little wonder, though, isn't it, that we've become a nation of doubters? Pick up this morning's paper. All of the inconsistencies, the unknowns, the changes, the chaos that's going on in our country and has seemed to have morphed and spread like a contagion across the globe. It's no wonder we are doubters. But my problem with this, the super duper problem with all this, is we let this doubt, this I don't know, this whole ongoing event of doubt that has overtaken us, it's come to the point now where we are susceptible, that's what I want to say, to doubting Jesus, our trust in our belief in Jesus. For the past couple of years, I've been working on this, on that dissertation. And in the process, I interviewed hundreds of people all across the country, a few people from across the world. I got a hold of I shouldn't tell you this, I suppose, but I got a hold of a mailing list of about 350 parents of children across the country and across the world who have some form of cancer, which is what our background is. And so that's how I was able to get this organization called Candlelighters gave it to me. It's amazing what you find out when you start sending out a message to ask you, how are you doing? How has this affected your beliefs? All these people had one thing in common, every one of them. They were in bereavement at one stage or another, and there are several stages. You can hear, or in the case of the surveys I sent out, hundreds of them, you can read the shadow, you can feel the shadow of sorrow that's covered them and envelops them. And invariably, they want to know one thing above all else, and that is, where was Jesus when we needed him most? Why has God abandoned us and let this happen? Maybe God caused this to happen. Some people on the survey said it was God's will. We from New Jersey have a phrase for in response to that, which I won't share. But you see, it's become a common response to those who are in deep sorrow, in bereavement. But the next thing that happens is, and coincides with this, is anger. That's the next common denominator that you hear. Anger, that somehow God has let this happen. And they're angry at God. And the fallout from that is unbelievable. They leave church. They go to mediums. I've met a group who go to mediums to invoke the presence of their loved one. Maybe. Who am I? But you see, their belief in Jesus has somehow or other been suppressed. Not too long ago, a few years ago, I visited a family of three young men. The big young men. These guys are big guys. And their mother was there on the bed. She had just passed away. Just moments earlier, and I had been told to maybe stop by there. Didn't know what I was walking into. But a few things became clear. That they were in the beginning stages of this bereavement. An unknown. What does this mean? How? Why? And their anger started to turn to distrust. One of them told me that their mother had brought all three of them up, to believe in God and believe in Jesus. Make sure they went to church and Sunday school every Sunday of their life. I don't know, I didn't have a collar on that day, but it did prompt the third one brother to say to me, "Who are you? How did you get in here? What are you doing here?" Well, that's enough to spook me. I mean, what do you say to three young big men struggling to understand why their mother has passed away? I explained, "Well, look, I'm a volunteer chaplain, and I just wanted to come by a visit, and I want to pray with you." That's when the other brother told me all about his mother teaching the three of them. And you wonder how much of that stuck with them now in this time of crisis. That's when the other brother said, "Where was this loving Jesus you talk about when our mother was sick and dying?" Now, I struggled with that internally. And as I do with my prayers, I have no idea what's going to come flying out of my mouth. And that happened that day, that morning, in response. I had no idea what I was going to say. But I heard myself saying this stuff, saying, "He was right here. He was right." And I didn't shout at him. I didn't want to intimidate him. But that's what was inside of me, the battle with whatever it is they were dealing with. And he was Jesus is still here. Still here with your mother right now. And she was with your mom all during her illness and her death. Her love for you was very real. I asked him, took a chance. I said, "I want you to do something for me. Actually, I want you to do something for yourself. I want you to look at your mother right now on the bed. Look at her face. What do you see there? Do you see anguish or hate or bitterness or anger or whatever? No, you see peace, don't you? See the peace on her face. It's the peace that Jesus gave her before she died. And that's why he's here in this room with you right now, for the same reason. And he's going to remain with you in the months and years to come, because that's when you're going to need him most. That's when you're going to need the peace of God. Believe me, it is a sorrow that never quite goes away." I think that's St. John's message in this gospel lesson. He wrote his gospel toward the end of the first century, you know, when non-believers and Jewish believers were all struggling to figure out, who is this Jesus that John and all these others that were still alive then are talking about? Boy, that reminds me of the times when we all struggle. Just like those early Christians, just like Thomas. And yet, John is teaching us a new lesson in this story. And I'm going to repeat what I said earlier, just to make sure you remember it. And that is to expect and believe that the resurrected Christ, who comes to us unbidden, unannounced, unexpected into our lives to rescue us from that pool of doubt and despair. I like to flip through the Bible every now and then, come and see if I can find something that's pertinent to what's going on in my life. And I stopped at the book of Hebrews. I confess to you, I have never read the book of Hebrews, not even in seminary. But I know what's in it. I know about it, enough to pass the exams. But in it, Jesus, I think it's the third chapter. It's only three or four chapters, you can't miss it. Jesus makes this promise. No strings attached. Listen to this. It says, "I will never leave you or forsake you. Do not be afraid. Do not doubt." In the name of the
the Father,
and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.